first weapon impacting upon the United States. The Reagan administration planned to make an unprecedented investment in command and control, spending about $18 billion on new early warning radars and communications satellites, better protection against nuclear weapon effects and electromagnetic pulse, the creation of a global positioning system, GPS, to improve weapon guidance and navigation, upgrades of the bunkers at SAC headquarters in Omaha and at Site R within Raven Rock Mountain, and an expansion of Project ELF, the extremely low-frequency radio system for sending an emergency war order message to submarines. Three new ELF antennae would be built in Upper Michigan, one of them 28 miles long, the others about 14 miles long. Project ELF was a scaled-down version of Sanguine, a plan that had been strongly backed by the Navy. It would have buried 6,000 miles of antenna, 4 to 6 feet deep, across an area covering almost one-third of the state of Wisconsin. One of the principal goals of the new command and control system was to ensure the continuity of government. The vice president would assume a larger role in the planning for nuclear war and would be swiftly taken to an undisclosed location at the first sign of a crisis, ready to serve as commander-in-chief. New hideouts for the nation's leadership would be built throughout the country, and mobile command centers, housed in tractor-trailer trucks and transported by special cargo planes, would provide a backup to the National Emergency Airborne Command Post. During the Kennedy administration, the problems with America's command and control system were deliberately hidden from the public. But as President Reagan prepared to adopt an updated version of flexible response, the issue of strategic command was discussed in newspapers, books, magazines, and television news reports. Desmond Ball, an Australian academic, made a strong case that a nuclear war might be impossible to control. John D. Steinbrenner, who'd helped to write a top-secret history of the nuclear arms race for the Pentagon in the 1970s, reached much the same conclusion, warning that a nuclear decapitation of America's leadership could be achieved with as few as 50 warheads. Steinbrenner had read the classified studies on decapitation that so alarmed Robert McNamara, but did not mention them in his work. Bruce G. Blair, a former Minuteman officer, described how the command and control systems of the United States and the Soviet Union were now poised on a hair trigger, under tremendous pressure to launch on warning if war seemed likely. Paul Bracken, a management expert at Yale University, wrote about how unmanageable a nuclear exchange would be. And Daniel Ford, a former head of the Union of Concerned Scientists, revealed that, among other things, the destruction of a single innocuous-looking building in Sunnyvale, California, located within bazooka range of Highway 101, could disrupt the operation of Air Force early warning and communications satellites. Although many aspects of Reagan's strategic modernization program provoked criticism, liberals and conservatives agreed that a robust command and control system was essential to wage nuclear war or to deter it. In the fall of 1981, Secretary of Defense Weinberger announced the retirement of the Titan II. The missile was increasingly regarded as a relic of another nuclear era. Testifying about the Titan II before the Senate, Fred Eakley cited its low accuracy and its accident proneness. The enormous yield of a single W-53 warhead had become less important. The 100 Peacemaker missiles scheduled for deployment would carry 1,000 warheads, almost 20 times the number carried by the remaining Titan II missiles. And the secrets of the Titan II had recently been compromised. Christopher M. Cook, a young deputy commander at a Titan II complex in Kansas, had been arrested after making 3 unauthorized visits and multiple phone calls to the Soviet embassy in Washington, D.C. Inexplicably, Cook had been allowed to serve as a Titan II officer on alerts for 5 months after his first contact with the Soviet embassy was detected. An Air Force memo later said the information that Cook gave the Soviets about launch codes, attack options, and the missile's vulnerabilities was a major security breach, the worst perhaps in the history of the Air Force. Despite the obsolescence of the Titan II, its decommissioning would proceed slowly. The last missile was scheduled to go off alert in 1987. In order to save money, the Air Force decided to cancel some of the modifications recommended by the Titan II review group after the accident in Damascus. Funding would not be provided for a new vapor detection system in the silo, additional video cameras within the complex, or a retrofit of the W-53 warhead with new safety mechanisms. Upgrading the warhead to meet modern nuclear safety criteria for abnormal environments would have cost about $400,000 per missile. The Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, the breakdown in détente, the tough rhetoric from the White House, and the impending arrival of cruise missiles and Pershing II missiles created widespread fear of nuclear war in Western Europe. The fear was encouraged by a Soviet propaganda campaign that sought to stop the deployment of America's new missiles. But the apocalyptic mood in Europe was real, not communist-inspired, and loose talk by members of the Reagan administration helped to strengthen it. Thomas K. Jones, an undersecretary of defense, played down the number of casualties that a nuclear war might cause, arguing that families would survive if they dug a hole, covered it with a couple of doors, and put 3 feet of dirt on top. "It's the dirt that does it," Jones explained. "Everyone's going to make it if there are enough shovels to go around." In Great Britain, membership in the campaign for nuclear disarmament soon increased tenfold. A 250,000 CND supporters attended a demonstration in London's Hyde Park during the fall of 1981, and a well-publicized women's peace camp grew outside the Royal Air Force Base, Greenham Common, where American cruise missiles would soon be housed. In Bonn, a demonstration against the Pershing II missile also attracted 250,000 people. The sense of powerlessness and dread, the need to take some sort of action and halt the arms race, led to a nuclear version of the Stockholm Syndrome. Throughout Western Europe, protesters condemned American missiles that hadn't yet arrived, not the hundreds of new Soviet missiles already aimed at them. The New Yorker magazine ran a 3-part article in February 1982 that catalyzed the anti-nuclear movement in the United States. Written by Jonathan Schell and later published as a book, The Fate of the Earth revived the notion that nuclear